Myself.
Okay, welcome everybody to this week's installment of Jewish art, symbolism, sometimes idolatry. So today we're going to be discussing the menorah. So as far as, before we actually get started, what would everybody here like to discuss about the menorah? Before I start the slideshow, just make sure that I hit all the points in case you have other things that aren't on the slideshow that people are interested in. Prior. So just say, like, just shout out some things that you're curious about the menorah. We'll see if we can cover that.
I would say, when did it become a symbol beyond its use in the Beit HaMikdash?
Very good.
And the other thing I want to know is what halachot are there making too accurate a representation?
Both of those will be covered. So one of those is based on a nice traditional halachic sources. Other one of those is based on some more interesting academic works. But we'll see how they go.
How about the Arch of Titus? Whether it's really the menorah or not,
also will be addressed. We'll also be addressing what the various opinions are as to what the menorah looked like. There's a lot of so I think. I might be mispronouncing her name, but Rachel Hachlili. So she has, two books of several hundred pages discussing the menorah in terms of, what it means, as well as in terms of its development as a symbol. They'll be quoted as we go on. And so there is actually a lot of debate as to, all the various depictions, how many of them are accurate depictions, how many of them are representative, and it gets quite messy. So we'll only focus on a few of them, because if we focused on all of them, well, she had 200-300-page books, so we probably would be here for quite a long time. So here we go. So, the menorah. So, and next slide. Here we go. Okay. So we're going to look at the main points are: what was the menorah made out of, and what did it look like? We'll discuss what it looked like is according to the biblical account, as well as according to sources from the Second Temple, as well as according to archaeology, of course, from halachic sources as well. We'll also discuss when it was used as a Jewish symbol, like when did that first start being the case, as well as the question of can you make your own menorah or not? So as far as what does the menorah look like, so most people's first impression is what you see, here, made by the Mechon Mikdash, right? This is their menorah that they made for, which will hopefully use when the Beit Mikdash is speedily rebuilt in our days. So that's this menorah. Right, so this menorah is modeled largely after the Arch of Titus. So hopefully everybody here is familiar with the Arch of Titus. But again, we'll get to it in a little bit. So that's the one that they made. We'll also see there's some unique differences that are also relevant that we'll also end up discussing. So this is the stylized menorah. So again, made of solid gold. So the question in order to find out more about that, let's look into some of the halachot. So, or beginning with the verses. So the first thing to look at is in Sefer Shemot, in Parshat Truma, we have the commandment to construct the menorah. So there's a lot of details here. So again, I'm not going to read them all out in just the time. So let's focus on the fact that it is menorah zahav tahor, right? It's a pure gold menorah. Miksha tesem menorah yiricha v'kana gavia katarea v'racha mimena hiyu. So we're going to make the whole menorah is made out of one piece of beaten gold. That includes its legs, its arms, its cups, its flowers, and decorations. So again, this includes the six branches stretching out, as well as the various cups, flowers, and almond-like decorations on it. And also there are seven menorot places for the oil and wicks to go in. And the way that it was made is exactly the way that Moshe saw on Har Sinai. So as far as a little bit more in that regard, so let's I'm going to put down the slideshow in case anyone wants to look back at any of these sources afterwards. So, blowing up the window. Okay. So, here we go. So if you want a little shorter summary without all the details of, you know, how many of them and how many of each is the total number. So we have the shorter version in Sefer Bamidbar, right? Where we simply hear that this is how they made it. It's all made it all one piece, right? All beaten. And it's made exactly as God showed Moshe. And there we go, right? So what it looked like, that's the second version because, well, want all the details, go look in Shmo. So this is all very nice. So we know a little bit about the decorations, but how exactly did it work? Did it look? So not entirely clear because as opposed to the rest of the items in the Mishkan, we don't actually hear about its size, how tall it is, how wide it is. So we don't actually know. We know it has seven branches, you know, as a central stem. It has some sort of base and it has six arms. We're not exactly sure, and it has some decorative pieces to it. We're not exactly sure how it's going to turn out looking in the end. So let's dive in a little bit more and see if we can get a little more information out of that. You're right. Again, we know it made it of one piece, right? Sorry, you're right. We're with pure gold, seven branches, uses oil, and it's cups and flowers adorning it, but we don't actually know more than that from the psukim, which is a problem. But we'll have to get to that. So to fill that in, luckily we have the Torah Sheba'al Peh, and here we have this in the Gemara Menachot, where it describes the height of the menorah of it being 18 tefachim tall. We see that the base was a height of 3 tefachim, and then there was 2 tefachim that had nothing on it. And then we had the goblet, the knob, and the flower. And then there's another bare section. And above that, there was a knob 1 hand breadth above. And then 2 branches emerged from that knob. And yeah, so I could keep, so then similar series repeats all the way up till we reach the top, which is just again crowned by a 3 goblets, a knob, and a flower. Okay. And as far as what they looked like, they were similar to Alexandrian goblets, which were long and narrow. And the knobs, were they compared to? They're the shape of apples, of the I'm not gonna pronounce it correctly. The Cheritites, the flowers were the similar to, they're like the ornaments that are etched in the columns. And there, so in total, there are 22 goblets, 11 knobs, and 9 flowers on the menorah. Okay, so yeah, so now we have a rough depiction. But what is the question that you're hoping that you'd have seen by now that is not listed here? Whether it is straight or curved, right? We know how many there are. We know that there's some sort of base. We don't actually have enough details to know whether the question is it round or is it straight. So as far as that goes, so there's a debate within the commentators as to whether it's diagonal or straight. So on one hand, we have Rashi, who says, the cone will come out so on each side, it'll go out slantwise, meaning diagonally, and that's how it'll go up. On the other hand, we have the Ibn Ezra, who says that they're rounded. So as it stands right now, so again, so I'm sure we will see both rounded and straight. So again, it's two opinions amongst the early commentators, and that's seemingly that. So the question is that really it? So as far as ironing out exactly who holds which opinion, so a lot, everybody likes arguing about what is the Rambam's opinion. So let's look at the Rambam's opinion. So based on what the Rambam says in Mishnah Torah, it's not clear because he makes no mention of the curvature of the arms. Now that he mentioned it in his Parash Mishnahs, but what he does, here's a Ktav Yad that is a manuscript that is currently housed in Oxford. They acquired in the late 1600s of Rambam's original writing of the Parash Mishnayot. So this is a diagram that Rambam himself made, and right, again, he signed it, not on the image, but again, on the overall manuscript. So we know that was definitely Rambam's. So here we have, seeing this is where all of the various cups and knobs go, right, and flowers. So again, so you can see how they're all lined up, with the triangles being the flowers, the circles being the knobs, and the things that look like cups being the cups.
Is it curious that this doesn't appear anywhere in his other works, Mishnah Torah?
Right. So the issue is that it's not, so as in that it is curious, but it's entirely likely that he had it, just it was never copied over. Meaning as in, this is how he drew it. This is how his son, Rabbi Avram ben Harambam, testifies to having been done on the diagonal. So Rambam's opinion most likely is that this isn't, again, this is what his son thought as well as what his own writing looks like. And that's what you, and that's why most likely that's the Rambam's opinion.
But has the Rambam written anywhere in his works describing it in words, or all we have is this picture?
No, all we have is this picture, which is the problem. So his son says he meant that it was straight down the diagonal, not curved at all.
I was thinking that, maybe it's not his, it's not the Rambam's pattern to draw any diagrams in his works. Like maybe we don't find other examples where he drew things, has he?
So he does, but again, we don't have that many depictions of his that have survived. Again, the fact we have even any of his original is absolutely astounding, to be perfectly honest with you. Like any manuscript, original manuscript surviving is, you know, basically a miracle, because like it should not have survived, you know, the 800 or so years since he passed away. Like that's just, you'd never expect manuscripts to survive. That's general rule of thumb. Like especially the original that the person wrote when it's hundreds of years, it's just, you know, you never really expect that.
And also why was it, why do you think it was only popularized by Chabad rather than other Orthodox groups?
So that's because, well, the Rebbe made a point of caring about it and was very outspoken about it, and he encouraged his many students to do the same. So hence, that's why they were very behind it. Everybody else was more or less in the camp that it's not necessarily Ma'akev, because it's not Ma'akev, and therefore, if you're choosing a hill to die on, this wasn't the one most people wanted to die upon.
They're also huge proponents of the square luchot. You know, when everybody else was doing curved.
Correct. But as in a lot of these things, and the question is, are they, you know, again, let's say if I made a round, rounded menorah, it would still be a kosher menorah, right? It's not one of the features of the menorah that the Rambam, the Rambam lists the feature, and the Gemara lists features that are necessary components that if the menorah doesn't have, it's not a valid menorah. And at no point listed there is the curvature of the arms. Right, it says it's made out of gold. Yeah, the question, you know, we're not going to get into the which parts are Ma'akev or not. It's made out of gold. For more on that, please see the Rambam in the third parak of Hilchot Beit HaBechira, where he discusses where he discusses at length. We have time at the end. I'm happy to go through exactly that. But again, for now, just the reason why it hasn't been so discussed is mostly because it's not Ma'akev, and people were pretty happy with whatever they had, and they're like, oh, there's two opinions, so we picked opinion A, not B, and that's fine, right? As we saw, there's, you know, on the one hand we had Rashi, and learning we had Ibn Ezra, right? So again, right, two conflicting opinions happen all the time in various discussions. There's also the question, let's say if you're going to make the priestly garments of the Kohen Gadol, right, of the high priest, you know, when you you know, on the bottom of the bells and the pomegranates, the question is how you do that. So Rashi, for instance, says you have pomegranate bell. On the other hand, you have the Rambam, who says, the Nachmanides, Ramban, who says, no, just you had a bell inside of each pomegranate, and then that's how it looked, right? So you have two, as in, it matters, but it's not necessarily Ma'akev, there's two, meaning it won't necessarily mean that the, you know, if you were to make the begadim for the Kohen Gadol, it'll be no good. So therefore, it's not necessarily a problem.
But isn't it funny that the Torah goes into excruciating detail, sometimes eye glazing, about the Mishkan and Tfachim and, you know, and knobs and sockets, and something so basic as this is glossed over?
Right. So that's, some people say that's part of the reason. So one of the suggestions is that because you were given a little bit of leeway in terms of making of the menorah, that you could have made it as long as it checks the boxes, you have artistic license to edit to append other things, right? So when we say knobs, we say flowers, we say cups, that's not very specific. There are thousands of flowers, right? Cups, also many variations. Knobs, what's a knob, right? And then like, there are many different, you know, shapes, curves, like you could, you know, adjust it and they would still fall under the, you know, it's still made out of one pure piece of metal, so therefore it's perfectly fine to use. So then that's one of the arguments saying that, in, for instance, in the first temple, there was 11 total. Shlomo HaMelech made 10 other menorah. So some opinions say that, you know, that there are many other different there are different menorahs made. So yes, Moshe's may have looked one way or the other way, but odds are that the permutations that you've seen were included in those original 11, and then in the second temple, it may have, you know, consolidated into one version. Because, well, there's only one in the second temple, so again, not that they're all invalid, just that we may have, you know, debated over a long time, right? So again, so Chabad very much was a strong proponent of it, but again, yeah, hopefully that's making some sense. So you're right, it's a good question. There's necessarily a good answer as to why not, but it's also worthy to note that it's not one of the features that is, that would mean that your menorah is no good, whether straight or curved. So worry not, even if the one of the Mechon Mekdash isn't exactly correct, it's still going to be a valid one. So also note that Rambam says there has to be 3 feet, right? So the question then will also become, we'll see, as we will note, is that there aren't necessarily 3 feet on the one that we saw in the, here, let's go back quickly. So if we go back to the here, right? So it doesn't really look like there's 3 feet. Right, there's a big base, but not really 3 feet. So what's up with that? So to that effect, so let's go back and look at some of the. So now we've looked at the halakhic sources and discussed halakhic outside. And we'll get to the are making our own ones for shul at the very end. Not to worry. But the question then is: so people were alive at the time of the second temple. So what did they when they and they made a lot of images of the menorah and. The question is, you know, how much validity will we give those? Well, that's always a good question in terms of talking about history. How much validity does archaeology have? Which is debated very heavily. For instance, the Chazon Ish is a Rabbi Shai Karelitz is very against the use of archaeology because he says that, well, who's to say things haven't changed? Maybe they were, you know, maybe it's some other, you know, artistic depiction of something, or in terms of say a place name, it's like who said place wasn't destroyed, because we know that cities have been destroyed repeatedly and move a little bit. You know, you theory of thought it was this hilltop, but that hilltop was destroyed, moved to the next hilltop, or moved, you know, a mile down the road. You never really know. So even if you were to see something, it's not necessarily the case. So, but that's a separate debate of how much you can use our archaeological sources, which is if you want to settle and share on that, I can give one. But for now, let's assume that it has some validity. So let's look at a little bit of archaeology. So the first attestation we have is on the coins of Antigonus Hasheni, who was the last Hasmonean king, right? He is the last Hasmonean king because he actually was tried being king after Herod had already taken over, and he rebelled against Herod. He rebelled for 3 years. And ultimately failed. But while he was rebelling, he made coins on which side was the menorah, and on the reverse side was the lachem apanim. Right.
I'm just wondering if we can bring any proof from the Hasmonean kings since they were wicked.
It may have been wicked, but they weren't stupid. Meaning is that they may have been wicked in terms of their rule and they're not listening and they're not doing the right thing. But as far as if they're choosing a symbol that's deliberately making a play for, in this case, right, he's the king and high priest. So if you're going to try and, you know, pick two of the most central symbols of the temple, you're not going to draw it wrong.
Okay, good point.
Right? It has to be somewhat related to what it looked like. Otherwise, everyone thinks you're an idiot in addition to you're being a bad person. In which case, your rebellion is not going very far at all.
Okay.
Right? Right. So then here we see, the menorah must have looked to some degree like this. Otherwise, it would be really weird if you're saying, like, hey, I'm high priest. I light this all day. I put the bread on this. And it's like, are you blind too? Like, that would not go over very well. So that's why we're assuming for now that, so that's why that would be a relatively good attestation. As far as what the engravings are, again, we'll leave that aside for now. Again, for all they mean, again, as you can tell, it's not very clear on the coins. It's pretty run down. So again, so if you want to see more discussion as far as each and every archaeological thing I'm going to be citing, so please look at Rachel Hachlili's The Menorah Evolving into the Most Important Jewish Symbol, where her second book on the about the menorah, where she discusses basically every single archaeological find in the last several centuries, debating, you know, that may or may not relate to the menorah.
Okay, I was going to ask you that, based on the answers you gave a couple lectures ago, one couldn't ask that the Rambam was wrong, because if the Rambam saw this, he may also have changed his diagram, correct?
So Ramban, Nachmanides?
Rambam.
So I'm saying, so we know that Nachmanides would have. I'm not sure whether or not Rambam would have.
But I thought you said Rambam was a rationalist based on science, and if he saw this, that would have swayed him.
Again, but that's it's possible, but it's also possible you could say that, well, the Chachamim and I were wrong, or that the Koran is a forgery. So that's why I can't necessarily, meaning as in here, cases where he was, where he changed based on what would be, let's say, where he acknowledged that the Aleppo Codex was the Ketoram Soba, was the best version of Tanakh, and he edited his Tanakh against it. But that's not necessarily, that, you know, a manuscript that was, you know, been seriously kept, and not necessarily something that was dug out of the ground. So okay. There are no attestations, as far as I know, about the Rambam stumbling upon ancient coins and changing his mind based on them, as opposed to for Nachmanides, where we do see him changing his mind based on seeing of archaeological, either finding of coins or in terms of you know, seeing the geography of Israel, he changed his commentary at times. So then I simply don't know if there's any data about the Rambam changing his mind based on archaeological evidence. So yeah, I'll look into it if I can find anything, but I just don't know, because I don't know if we have evidence of him having changed his mind based on that. So Nachmanides, yes, Maimonides, not so much. Again, he may or may have, because I'm not sure if we have any direct evidence of him ever having changed his mind based on it. So that's why I'm not sure whether he would change his mind. So, but there's also the definite option that the even though during the Bayit Sheni this was the case, it also could be that even though that was the menorah that they had by the Chashmonaim, but you could also say that the Chashmonaim built the wrong menorah. It's also completely valid to say, since they're wicked, so we can say that, hey, they decided to build a menorah according to, you know, to make it look more pagan, not because it's actually what they should have been building, right? Meaning you could definitely try and make that argument. Whether it's valid or not is a separate question, but you could try to make that argument. So this is one source we have testify as to what during the Second Temple would it look like. Again, was it different during the First Temple or not? We just simply don't know, because we don't have anybody really discussing it and describing it. We have the Pesukim from Shemot and Bamidbar, and then we don't really hear much about the structure of the menorah. We do hear about the you know, in Zechariah, but that's already the very beginning of the Second Temple, so it's not necessarily helping us as to what it looked like during the First Temple. So, okay. So
I think someone's mute isn't on, because I can't really hear.
That's my newborn son.
Oh, sorry.
I know it's you. Well, put him on mute.
Okay, he found his pacifier again. I'll be okay. All right. So, yeah. Okay. So, yeah. All right. So the next, you know, historical find that, you know, depiction of it, again, exact dating is unclear, but it's roughly down to 40 CE, is the in Migdalah or Migdal, right? Depending on modern day Migdal, then referred as Magdala, right? So this is a, when they were digging up a ancient synagogue, they found this. They saw this depiction of the menorah. Okay, so as you see here, right? So again, there are seven branches. It looks kind of rounded, but it's a little straighter than the other one. But also, as you can probably tell, it's not the finest embroidery work we've ever seen. In terms of, you know, stone chiseling, you know, you've seen far more impressive ones. You'll see in just a second. So they're not necessarily bad attestation, but it looks like, again, there's a nice square. There's a nice, you know, nice base. And it does look like it's kind of rounded, and there's seven branches, right? Again, not the best, but again, this is, you know, some people try to argue that because here it looks like the arms are a little straight-ish, that therefore it wasn't round nor was it straight. It was actually, you know, somewhere in between. But the problem being is that, well, this is a, you know, they didn't really get the perfect roundness on their round jugs either. So I'm not sure I could trust this sculptor's technical skill. Just in my completely amateur opinion. But again, that's debated. For more on that, again, see how clearly it's booked, where she discusses whether or not that's likely or not. So this was discovered in 2009. So again, this is a relatively recent discovery. The stone. So that, but of course, the one that we're all probably waiting to see and can see more about is the Arch of Titus, right? So this was constructed roughly 10 years after Titus destroyed the temple with his father for his vision. And here we have his very nice, you know, triumphal arch making fun of the Bethetic Jews who had all their items stolen from them. Again, note the taking of the menorah as well as the shulchan here, which are very important. That, you know, again, very important in terms of the work of the temple, and they're being sacked and taken away. So now let's zoom in a little bit. Okay. So would like to point out that here we'll see better pictures in a second, but note that as far as the view, again, this isn't perfectly preserved, but you also note that there is some other designs on the base that we'll see a little closer in just a second. All right, so the question is, so what's going on with some of the detailing on the menorah? So here is, again, Hasli Lee has a nice, you know, again, a little more zoomed in, and also the artist, you know, etching of it, which, you know, makes it a little bit easier to see as opposed to the stone depiction. But again, you can note that, you know, this is definitely far more fine stonework, you know, like several leagues better than what we saw at the stone in Migdala. Like, again, one of these is clearly, you know, a master stonemason. One of them is not a master stonemason, right? So again, so here you can see the fine detail that goes in, right? You can see what looks to be, you know, the cups and the knobs and the flowers, right? Going all the way up, right? Some added detailing, right? So it looks quite nice, right? And then also worthy of note, that some of this that leads to that's very much highly debated is you notice on the base. So what would you call these things? On the base, what would you say they are? What do they look like? What animal is
zodiac? Zodiac?
I mean, not quite the zodiac.
Okay, mythical creatures.
The tribes?
Right, so it's a mythical creature either being the dolphin or a sea dragon, right, is what most people's, you know, or mermaid, is what these suggestions have been. But whatever it is most definitely is not something that is normally listed as part of the, you know, what you'd expect to see in the Mikdash. It's not a kruv. It's not, again, it's not a lion. It's something else, right?
But so still, as a general comment, I don't know if you said this already, but isn't this example far away the best because they actually saw it? In other words, instead of somebody else just making an image in the first century, they actually saw it.
I think
Chabad say this is a menorah, not necessarily the menorah.
Correct. Their argument is that there are multiple menorahs made. This simply is one of them, right?
Yeah, wait. I don't get that. Sorry, Mark. I don't understand what that means.
So
they took various spoils and they took a candelabrum, and it's not necessarily this isn't necessarily what was in the Beit HaMikdash.
It's kind of hard to believe, don't you think, that if they're marching with it, this is a piece de resistance. This is the item. I don't know.
Maybe this one was prettier.
Yes, they could have just taken the fanciest one, the other one that was used. So again, we'll get to the fact of how many menorahs there were or there were in a little bit. We'll get there. Also, according to the rabbinic account, how many there were also. So again, but as far as, again, so the question, what do you do about these weird things on the base? So Chabad would say, hey, this clearly shows forgery. There's no way that, or it's not the real one, because why on earth do they have these on it? Alternatively, other explanations I've heard have been, basically this was the way of the Romans defacing the menorah, because they're putting their gods on it to say, ha ha ha, we beat you, so we're gonna you know, stick on our gods on top of your menorah, because there's no, even though they weren't necessarily there to begin with. So that's why if you were to look at the So two examples of how to avoid that particular issue of having there being, you know, weird sea creatures on your menorah. So one option is you can go the way that the right. So see what they did here at the Mechon Mikdash. They did some nice stylized patterns, like, you know, flowers type things that look kind of similar from a distance, but definitely are not any animal in any way, shape, or form. That's how they managed to solve that problem. Okay, now it's forward a lot of slides. Sorry, here we go. So also interesting note in terms of what did the menorah look like. So Professor Stephen Fine of Yeshiva University did some very interesting research in that regard. So he, using spectroscopy and a whole bunch of other techniques to detect the original colors that were on the Arch of Titus. Again, whenever you think of a Roman depiction, you're always like, oh, of course, it's just this beautiful stone with nothing on it. Well, unfortunately, that's not how it was. They actually knew how to use paints too. So again, while you may, even though you always think of all Roman structures as being something, you know, beautiful stonework, well, it was beautiful stonework, but then they painted it. So assumption being is that their paintings were actually pretty good, pretty lifelike, as we've seen based on other places. You know, based on, you know, what we've seen surviving of Pompeii, like, it's actually, odds are that they got the coloring right. They didn't, you know, just, you know, not like, you know, like, oh, beautiful art, and they colored it, like, orange for the face. You're like, really? Like, come on, like, you had such a beautiful work of art, and you just painted to the guy's face orange? No, that's not what they did. So here what they did, using that and 3D imaging and a whole bunch of other fancy techniques. For more on that, please, you can click through the link later or read through his paper presentation. But again, we don't have time for that. So here is when they, here, so this is what the colors they found to be on each individual, on the faces as well as the bodies when they did the whole thing. Again, not going to go through how they did it because, again, they're not part of our discussion today. But here, again, they did a 3D scan and coloration based on the tone via the spectroscopy. And they were able to see things you couldn't necessarily see before, right? So what I'd like to focus on, what also allowed them to do in terms of a better picture of the menorah and of the end of the Shulchan. So focusing in on the menorah, so they say it was able to reconstruct the dolphins better, as well as some of the words that translate to be the sacred treasure of the Jews, lampstand of the Jews, and law of the Jews. In case you're wondering what on earth those weird signs they're holding were, so the answer is that what they were holding. That's what those signs meant. So as far as then why there was part of the spoils, that's explaining why they were there, which is helpful to know what was written there.
What was the law of the Jews?
Law of the Jews would have been legis.
Pardon?
Left. This is Latin. I apologize for not pronouncing it right. But legislation would, on the left here, that would be the law of the Jews.
No, I'm saying, were they carrying a book or something?
Not that survived.
Okay.
It could be that one of the things may once have been that, and like the part that fell off. We don't, like, you know, maybe one of the guys holding a Sefer Torah, but we don't see that. So therefore, okay, we don't actually know. But good point. Okay. So, and another way around the weird, dolphins, sea creatures, etc., is on the emblem of the state of Israel. As you see here, where they kind of just put squiggles and they're like, yeah, we like it, but we're not actually going to put, you know, idolatrous things on our symbol because, well, we're Jewish. So, nah. Okay. So, but as far as, you know, its use is past that point. So we'll know that as time moves on, that people's, the depictions started to get a little more elaborate. Note here the fact to hear that as opposed to before, the base being relatively square. So then we can start moving into the actually following the Gemara in terms of having, you know, three legs, fully three legs, and not such a big base. Also note that the flowers here are pomegranates, but we'll leave that aside. Right. So this was in the mosaic on the floor of Hamat Tveria that we saw the other week. So again, here we see people liked putting it in on the floor of the various synagogues, and eventually developed, and nowadays we often see it on the walls of synagogues. So the question then is, well, if you're going to start doing that, well, is that okay? Right? Can I start putting it on the walls or not? So to that, we have to look back in the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah that also we discussed several weeks back. We're talking about seven of the stars. So we learn out that a person's not allowed to copy the celestial bodies. You also can't copy the various elements of the temple. So therefore, you can't make you can't make your house look like the Beit HaMikdash. The same dimensions as the courtyard or the table looking like the Shulchan did, or a menorah looking like the menorah did. So what can you do if you want to have a menorah that kind of looks like the menorah that you made if it isn't? So the solution is quite simple. You use either 5, 6, or 8 lamps. Why not fashion it with 7 lamps, even if it's from another kind of metal other than gold? Because the reality is that in the Beit HaMikdash, you could have made it out of another metal, even not gold. So therefore, right, if you're ever making it your menorah, your Chanukah menorah, make sure that your Chanukah menorah has 8 branches, not 7. And similarly, Rabbi Yossi says you can't make a menorah out of wood, which is the way that the Chashmonaim made theirs as well, which is a problem. You're like, wait a minute, does that mean that in the Mikdash they originally used, at one point they used a wood one? So the Gemara debates back and forth, yes or no. But clearly, one opinion is that, yes, the menorah immediately following the Hanukkah story was made out of wood. So that would imply that you can't make it out of wood either, which is a problem. So then the sages say back to him, that's not really true, because rather, that never happened. Again, it may have happened. We don't really, there's no way to know the husband I've ever copped to it. So that wasn't written in Book of Maccabees or anything else. Like nobody actually said like, oh, we made one out of wood. Oops. So then we don't really know. But so they say that originally they made of iron covered with tin. Later when they had a little bit more money, they made them out of silver. And later when they were really even richer, then they started making them out of gold. So again, so by showing that the problem is making the menorah or any other items in the Beit HaMikdash that are actually relatively accurate to the original depiction. The question is then, how close to being the real thing does it have to be for you to violate this prohibition? So in that regard, so there's the question of how close to it is. So some people say, as I mentioned before, that if it would theoretically have been a valid in order to use the Beit HaMikdash, that's definitely a problem. The question is, so how do you put a menorah in on the wall of your shul without being in violation? So one obvious answer is don't put a 7-armed menorah in your shul, right? That's what many poskim say, right? It's that simple. Just don't put 7 branch menorahs in your shul and we're good to go, right? Just don't. Make it 8, make it 6, right? But of course, you know, as people are wont to do, they tended to not necessarily follow the advice of the various rabbis, and they went ahead with these other options. And again, other rabbis, you know, said that it's fine as well. So here's a list of some of the ones that have been used over the years to say why it's not considered to be a problem. One, we know there's a problem is that it's for a functional menorah. So sometimes if you made it thin enough that way you wouldn't be able to stand, wasn't nailed to the wall, that's a solution. Because if you could ever actually light a candle with it in any way, shape, or form, right? Or you could ever put a lamp on top of it, any wicks or oil, that it's like, see, you can't call them menorah because it's not doing anything. So that's one solution. Another option is you say that if it's two-dimensional on the wall. So it's two-dimensional, so therefore just a painting. I could put painting on the wall, no problem, just like we had by the picture of the sun, one of the stars. Easy solution. Others say that, yes, I put a 7-armed menorah, but because I didn't put a base, so it can't actually stand on its own, that'll solve it. So other options are that in terms of the shape, they have the branches coming to. Either they have it coming in like in a diamond shape, like in a square-like shape, or in a circle. So therefore, they say, oh, that's not kosher for use in the Mikdash, and therefore that's well, it'll be okay. But other people say that's not true because at no point in the, you know, the Gemara or anybody in the Rambam does it say that they have to be actually entirely level. So therefore, since that's not ma'akev, therefore you can't. That's not a valid. That's not a valid solution. Others say that the answer is that when that people are making these, you know, these menorahs and shul, they generally use either electric lights or candles to put on top. And if there are electric lights or candles on top, well, that's definitely not good for the menorah in the Beit HaMikdash, because the menorah in the Beit HaMikdash used oil lamps and wicks. So if there is no receptacle for an oil lamp or wick, then guess what? You didn't make a menorah, you made something else. If you made something else, then it will not be prohibited. So again, sorry for running through that a little quickly. But the point being is that there are ways around it. But before, as I've said many times before, before adding any decoration to your synagogue, please consult with your local Orthodox rabbi, as well as your shul board, because you may run into some issues in that way, and you'd rather avoid all issues before you put it up, because there has been long traditions going back for millennia of dedicating the light fixtures in the shul, but it's important to you know, make sure that you print the light fixture that doesn't need taken down because it's done in a prohibited fashion. Okay, so then the next question that was asked was, you know, why did the menorah become the Jewish symbol? So here, right, so President Lily has some nice pointers for us and as to her theory as to why. Again, this is just, again, this is entirely speculative. Why were the Jews drawn to the menorah? But, you know, one could say, you know, a moth to a flame, so to speak. But here are her four general reasons that she gives, that there are more specific ones proposed by various scholars over the centuries, but here's what she says. Right, so the qualities of the menorah, the lamp, and preferred status as the most important symbol of Judaism are light, form, cult, and symbol. So now let's see what those four words mean, because they don't really mean anything. So light, meaning the main ritual significance was realized in illumination, because you light the menorah. And of course, the light is a very positive theme, and one that people tend to be drawn to. Again, moth to the flame. Another one is the form. The form of the menorah is unique, unusual, easily recognizable. So if you see a menorah somewhere, you'll be like, that's a menorah. You won't be like, I don't know, that's a square. Is that a shulchan? Is that a mizbeach? Or is it a square? It's like, no. When you see a menorah, you know it's a menorah. So, you know, if you're looking for an easy to recognize Jewish symbol, that's it. You'll see it. You'll know. That'll be that. Not a problem. Okay, another one is cult, meaning in terms of how it's used in worship. So the menorah was used in the daily ritual in the Mikdash, right? And also is also used daily in the shul. So each day in the Beit Hamikdash, it was lit. On the seventh day, also, okay, we'll leave that, her purpose, how she's saying how each day only one was lit, but Shabbos all seven were lit, because that's not really correct. We'll leave that away, we'll leave that aside. I'm not sure why she has that in there. But again, the question is, you know, again, point being is that the menorah was lit every day as part of the service. Daily and also similarly, not quite the same. We have every day in our shuls, we have the Ner Tamid, which is lit every day, which is meant to remind us of the menorah. So again, it's not the menorah, but again, it is the daily lighting that we have every day. Again, nowadays, typically it tends to be on 24/7, thanks to the magic known as electricity. But in the back of the day, they used to relight it every single day. And as well, the question is, what does the menorah represent in terms of the symbols of the numbers? So the seven arms represent the 7 days of the week or the seven planets. Again, for whether or not that's a valid one or not, relates to whether or not you think that there is Mazel Yisrael or not. The menorah function is a daily and a weekly ritual calendar. The menorah is a symbol characterized a place as a Jewish site or worship setting, and or a tomb as belonging to a Jew, which is, again, I didn't bring you all the various tomb inscriptions of menorah, but they're far more frequent and popular than the mummy.
So, Rabbi, you were breaking up last minute or so. If you could go back 1 minute, what you were sort of telling us.
All right. So as far as cult, right, that meaning, that was in terms of the use of daily ritual, right? And that's why, you know, the menorah is so popular, again, because you did what's done every day in the Beit HaMikdash. And similarly, we light a candle every single day as the Ner Tamid in our shuls, right? I mean, now it's continuously lit, but it used to be lit every day. Similarly, we also have the fact that the symbolism, we know there are seven branches of the menorah, which represent 7 days of the week. And also some would say that it might represents seven planets, but that's more a question of whether or not you think that Judaism cares about planets and is there mazel or not mazel. Do constellations of planets matter in Judaism, which will, again, that we discussed in the past.
Rabbi, yes. do you find it interesting that the secular Zionists also felt strong towards having the menorah as a symbol, even though it may be a religious symbol?
I mean, even the secular Zionists were not as secular as people import them to be, because they still believed in, you know, in Jewish culture and Jewish peoplehood. So while they may not have necessarily been practicing, they still held on to certain practices and beliefs. For instance, you know, even non-religious Jews light Hanukkah candles, right? And that's what I would think about the window, right? You know, while, you know, many other things did, right? So even the most secular families tend to light Hanukkah candles, even if they might not, you know, celebrate Friday night Kiddush or, you know, necessarily have a, you know, a Seder or make a spilled sukkah, they will most likely light Hanukkah candles.
Yeah, because I was because I know that when it came to, like, I know Masada is a very big symbol for a lot of secular Zionists too, you know, because it was warfare against the Romans. And it's just interesting because the menorah, you know, in Hanukkah was always the spiritual side of the holiday and not necessarily the military victories.
Right, but it also became a symbol of Hasmoneans. So it's.
I think it was the idea for the sovereignty of the country.
Correct. Right, the Hanukkah theme, right, and the Hanukkah story also tie into that as well, because that's all about the menorah. Right, so true, our menorah is 8, not 7, but then it directly ties in. Why Hanukkah? The fact that Hanukkah is so such a popular holiday, and then they're connected.
Okay.
So, and also again, menorah is also one of the ones they use again on every one of the festivals. They used to bring out the various kalim to show everybody. And as far as the one probably made the most impression, you know, that looks the most unique, odds are that was also the menorah, which also serves to be part of it as well. That was Rachel Klili. Again, if you want to, she goes through it at length in more detail in her first book than her second book. But again, search her up online. Just words of wise that a lot of things she says might be, for lack of a better term, kfira, in terms of, you know, going directly against urban tradition. But it is, but she does do a good job of presenting the archaeological material. So for other parts, if any of it seems, you know, a little strange and makes certain assumptions about the Jewish practice that are contrary to Chazal, the answer is because, well, it's following the academic consensus, not the religious consensus. So be that what it may. So just, you know, if you want to see the more religious approach, look at Stephen Fine's books on the topic. Those are more because he is, you know, he's a religious, again, that's generally his style of writing tends to be more on the more religious side. Actually took a course of them once. Very nice man. Anyhow, moving on. So just to summarize what we've discussed a little bit, again, if there's any further questions with the menorah, I'm happy to address it at the around now. So we discussed, you know, various shapes and materials that the menorah may be made out of. We discussed whether the branches were straight or curved. We discussed the type of base it has, you know, whether it's square or more of the tripod shape, and how the Mechon Mikdash one actually has both, because, well, they of course wanted to make it look like, because they're convinced that they put three little feet at the bottom of the of their mock-up of the one side of the arch, that way they could, you know, do both at the same time. They also discussed the height of it being, you know, 18 to 12 tall. Again, that's roughly, right, so it's like about 6 feet. So then we discussed the, whether you can place one in shul and how you can get her, and how you could, and how you do so. We also discussed why did the menorah catch on as a symbol and why people found it particularly meaningful. As far as exactly why, the answer is like, sometimes it just catches on. You know, we gave some reasons as to why, those aren't necessarily the reasons. So next week we're going to be continuing by talking about birds and their as a symbol in Judaism and how it shows up in art in various forms. And also I'd like to bring everybody's attention that this Sunday we're going to be having a program on Tisha B'Av, talking about various fasts, including Tisha B'Av and the like, about going beyond hunger, you know, what you're supposed to think about during fasting, when you should fast, when you shouldn't fast, and more in that regard. And if anybody has any questions in regards to the presentation, feel free to ask them now. And
I had a point just for feedback. I find during these classes the archaeological slides and things like that very interesting. So I just wanted to give you that feedback. That for me, it's something that I don't find that often. So I appreciate that. And just to follow up on this, I don't have to give a quick, a long answer, just a quick answer. Do you find, but the religious world, when it comes to these archaeological finds, be it coins or something else, they kind of pick and choose. In other words, when it fits their narrative, yes, it's great. The Torah is correct. Everything is fine. But they somehow ignore if they find something similar that may not fit the halachic story.
So the answer is no. Some might do that and be dishonest. Most of the scholars that I've met are very honest about whether or not it fit or doesn't fit with the the historical narrative, right? And sometimes the answer is like, Chazal weren't necessarily always intending to be historically accurate. So again, it would be a case-by-case issue. You'd have to like point out X case, X evidence, whether that supports or goes against it. But there's also a lot of, archaeologists who simply overstate their cases in an anti-religious fashion, despite the fact that there's not enough evidence to support it. Cases.
Yeah,
but because that is the debate that came up about the kosher, the bones of kosher fish. So there was an article that went around, about saying how, clearly they weren't, we found a lot of not kosher fish bones, so clearly they weren't keeping kosher. And, and the only problem with that is that that's entirely possible. Like, and then the archaeologists decided to say clearly. This shows that no one of the Jews knew about the Torah until, the Second Temple period. And everybody's like, wait, what? Like, that doesn't follow. What it follows is that there definitely were Jews who were, eating a not kosher fish. But they also failed to mention in that study, for instance, the fact that that when they were doing excavations in Ir David and in Yerushalayim area, they found, 95% of the bones found from kosher fish. So, and also in that find, they found there was more fish there than there was in fish bones than in any other dig the rest of Israel combined. So the person simply chose like the data and then made an extrapolation that his data didn't support. And he didn't, and he was just a good writer. So he wound up with a much better, he got a lot of FaceTime, but he wasn't like actually correct.
No, I was talking about when they found King Chizkiah's coin with his bullock with the, finish, with his official signature and a symbol he decided to put on was a sun disc, whatever it is. I just have a feeling that the yeshivish world would gloss over about what kind of people these kings were who decided what to put on their official stamp, which was very alien to Judaism.
So, not necessarily anti Judaism. It's like, for instance, nowadays, if you wanted to draw a picture of a sun, you probably draw a sun with, the random, sticks coming out of it. Right?
Right. Right.
So, as in, that's not correct. Like, that's not what it looks like. It doesn't have sticks coming out of it.
No, but why do you put a sun? He could have put a Torah on it. He could have put a shofar.
Right. So, then why he chose that as a symbol? Good question. Right.
He was assimilated.
The rising sun. Maybe he was playing deference to the Egyptians at the time. I don't know.
I don't want to prolong this, but I'm just curious. Couldn't you just say he may have been an assimilated Jew?
I mean, no. That would be the most indefensible position because you're arguing a single coin versus, all the mentioning in Tanakh. So
I take that.
That would be the answer. It's like you could figure out how does the coin fit into the rest. There's plenty. We have a lot of things written about him that. Okay. In terms of data, there's one overwhelmingly more than the other. So it's like, how did he find a principle if he was, very against idolatry, that he had a seemingly idolatrous sense? Symbols, so you could say a symbol was an idolatrous or it means something else, which is totally possible. But yeah, that would be the solution to that.
This reminds me of what you're saying with the archaeology. I've heard similar debates and discussions about the Murex snail and the Tehelet, and they go and they actually found like the snails that are like that they would find from the trading routes that were a couple thousand years old, and some were saying this is definitive proof that this is what else could it have been, and others saying we're not going to accept it since archaeology.
Right. So it's not definitive proof. It's it's probably correct, and it fits quite well. And to quote Rav Schaffner, I'll take my suffix and fulfillments for their rights as best as I can. Even if they're wrong. You don't lose anything. You may fulfill the mitzvah d'oraita much better. So, archaeology isn't definitive, but it's the best we got. So if you've got nothing else, may as well go with it.
I have a question. For the Chanukiah, we have certain halachot, but the Chanukiah has to have certain regulations. And if you want to make it look like the menorah, that's up to you, but it doesn't have to look like the menorah. That's what I'm suggesting. Is that
correct?
I have a question about the Chanukah as well. Isn't there something that has to be in a straight line? It can't be curved, like
right. So for right, so for that's it has to be in a. So is it? It needs to be clearly noticeable to the observer what day it is, how many you have lit. Right. So it's more of a practical function, not in terms of if the point is that the unlocker can see and say, oh, there are 7 candles lit. There are 6 candles lit is the main point. So as in, let's say you had it, done it a little bit, they're a little bit off, or, you've got to move forward and backward, but like somebody's looking straight on, like it looks like it's, you can still see 7, just like one slightly staggered back and forth. So that would be fine. The issue there is counting visibility is the issue. So it's a little bit different of a function, but as far as does that answer the question? And as far as
because you're talking about the menorah being like if it's in a circle,
right? It's bent, right, or different shape. So that's what someone would say that since that's not necessarily makiv in the menorah itself, in the base of Mikdash, therefore you can't, make one like that. Another question was about do you have to make it like. Again, your menorah can be made however you want to make the menorah. You can act all just perfectly fine and kosher. Just put 7 candles, like however many candles are that night, in a row. It's perfectly fine. I could do that many. That happens a lot. If you're lighting candles somewhere, somebody else's house, and they don't have spare menorahs, or if you're in a hotel and like you just have, you brought your bag of tea lights, and that's all you brought. Like that's perfectly fine, not a problem. And that's efficient. And as far as this is, if you're ever making a menorah, just make sure that you make it not look like the actual menorah. So.
Can we see the baby?
Oh, you can see the baby too. Yeah, let me just end the recording again. And next week we will give birth.